From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Amazon doesn't have a presence in Ireland, but it does allow Irish people to kind of piggyback on its presence in the UK.
Dublin has needed to build metro for at least 30 years. The best time to start doing it was probably in the 60s. Second best time is now.
Is it dangerous?
Yeah, definitely. I've hurt myself a lot.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily. Looking for a bargain? What about a sale that charges you more, not less? Your car is a plastic bag and it needs to have a levy on it. And when your child has to leave primary school for the final time and you're not invited. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that anybody would be happy to pay over the odds for. I'm just kidding, please don't at me. This morning's Ryan Tuberty Newsings start in an unusual place. Ireland's Eye magazine.
Strange thing about getting copies of Ireland's Own sent in to me by, I presume, Ireland's Own, which I think is based in Wexford, is that I kind of look at it going, gosh, it's the gift that keeps on giving. And then I find myself looking at a couple of pages going, that looks interesting. There's a quiz page for kids. It's nice. Bit of history there. Random lyrics to Frank Sinatra's song. It is so full of things. Didn't know, like this one, the last survivor of the 1905 mutiny on the Russian battleship Potemkin. You can, yeah, so where are you going with this? He settled in Dublin in 1913. He met Vladimir Lenin along the way. He met Jim Larkin along the way. But he set up a business. What business did he set up? Fish and chips. His name? Ivan Beshov. As in Beshov. Imagine. He was the last survivor of the battleship Potemkin. I didn't know that. I found that. Anyway, Ireland's Own. It's just that wonderful thing that keeps going, that we've talked about people sending it over to family abroad going, do you remember this? It's still here. Keep going. There's a whole piece on Princess Grace Kelly of Monaco. She came to visit her ancestral home in Mayo 60 years ago. And there's a picture in the Irish Examiner, isn't there, today of the Imperial Hotel staff member dressed as Grace Kelly, commemorating the stay there of Prince Rainier and herself at that time. I mean, she's such a beautiful actress and fairy tale story, isn't it, Grace Kelly? And very Irish, actually. I was doing a bit of looking into her story at one point, and it's all very real. And I don't know what they did with her home in Mayo. Did they turn it into a heritage point, or is it formal, or is it just a casual thing, or did they get involved? I'm not sure.
Somebody must know, right? Indeed, and somebody does.
And meanwhile, the Kelly homestead is the ruins of a house in the townland, sometimes misspelled Drumirle, or Drumirle, or Drumilra, near the town of Newport in County Mayo. The cottage has three rooms and overlooks the leg of Mutton Lake, and is situated on a boring off the R311 road from Newport to Castlebar. So it's just a ruin. It's not an established site that you can go and see by the looks of things. Okay, good to know that.
No interpretive centre. Disappointing. Anyway, well done, everybody. Finally, for today's Ryan Tuberty Show Newsings, some island culture new to Ryan.
My ongoing, I wouldn't say obsession, but more than a passing interest in Iceland continues apace. And people were telling us, oh, you know, Kaleo, the band, have you seen them? They perform on, you know, icebergs and fjords and very dramatic. But they're a massive band. And this band would have featured in TV shows like Blind Spot, The Blacklist, Lucifer, Supergirl, Grey's Anatomy, Vampire Diaries, Riverdale, Training Day, Suits, Teen Wolf, The Night Shift, trailers for things like Orange is the New Black and Empire and Logan and other things. This band is massive. And they're Icelandic rockers, quote unquote. And they have announced an Irish show at the Three Arena. So there are people listening to this going, why is that man talking about this band like he's never heard of them before? They're playing the Three Arena, you fool. Clearly they're massive. They've passed you by. You've been too busy with your stupid Tony Bennett records and your ancient ways. You don't get it, old man. You don't understand. But let's listen to them together. Here's a clip of them. Iceland's finest. Three Arena, 19th of June, 2022. They're giving you a whole year to get your... together.
won't do you no good. It won't do you no good. You better start running when you hear the man calling. It won't do you no good. It won't do you no good.
I could live with that.
Could you though? Could you really?
I definitely like the sound of that. Just one more, just to get another flavour. That song is called No Good from Kaleo. This is called Way Down We Go.
Yeah, but for the fuck, ooh, my heart, do you dare to look me right in the eyes, yeah. Oh, cause they be run you down, down to the door. Yeah, someday we run you down, down to the floor.
Good stuff. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. There's a bit of Twist of Hosier in there and others besides, but that's Kaleo. Tickets on sale Friday 25th of June at 9 a.m. for their gig in the Three Arena, the 19th of June 2022. So Iceland continuing apace to intrigue and fascinate.
Kaleo sounding slightly louder than Iceland's only other band, Sigur Rós, but still nuzzling their way into Ryan Tuberty's heart. And that's the blues rock ending to today's Newsings. Cars need to be treated like plastic bags with levies put on them. That's the view of Professor Brian Caulfield from the School of Engineering at Trinity College Dublin, who spoke to Clare Byrne this morning about a congestion charge for Dublin City. Conor Faulkner, transport commentator and former director of the AA, also joined the conversation, and Clare put it to him that given Ireland's emissions reduction targets, a congestion charge was likely to happen.
Well, not for the reasons of emissions, unless that's used as some sort of a kind of a false flag for a tax. But look, broadly speaking, I agree with the point made in that we do have to provide public transport. And really, we could talk about all of the other solutions, Claire, imaginative ones and creative ones and bicycle lanes and this, that and the other. But we must provide mass public transport in Dublin. We haven't done it yet. We're 30 years talking about the need for metro in Dublin. We still haven't delivered it. And once you do have a quality public transport system to offer people, you suddenly find you don't need a congestion charge. You don't need to force people out of their cars when you've got alternatives. If you look at the Lewis, for example, the lines that do run, or the DART system in Dublin, they provide an excellent service, and nobody has to be persuaded to leave the car at home. The public transport options are packed. So really, this is it's a point that I've made over the years, many, many times, but it remains a simple analysis. If you provide public transport and it's good, the citizens take to it in droves. They don't need to be forced. If you don't provide it, then no amount of forcing is going to help. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we could certainly keep traffic off the streets in Dublin tomorrow. We could achieve that with roadblocks, and that would be a traffic-free city. But it would cause enormous collateral damage. We need the city to function. There's more to it than stuffed olives and artisan coffee. It has to be a centre of industry and business, and that means a requirement for transport. And like it or not, in Dublin, the private car will, for the foreseeable future, be one significant component of that mix.
Okay, and Brian, what's the experience in other cities? So Conor is saying if you build it, they will come. There'll be no need for a congestion charge because people will use the public transport services that are in place. But London still needed to go ahead with their congestion charge despite having a very good public transport system.
They did, and the congestion charge there has reduced traffic on the order of about 15%. It has increased public transport usage. We see the same in Stockholm. The same thing happened there. But one argument I would give about the Lewis when it was built, a lot of people that used the Lewis basically transferred from bus to Lewis, so there wasn't as much decrease in car usage as we would have expected. So that's the kind of thing that I suppose I'm arguing for. When we put in all these public transport options, if the shift is just from a less efficient mode of public transport to the metro or the Lewis, then we're losing. We do need to get the people out of their cars, and that's the key target.
Okay, so you need to convert people. You're not taking people off the bus and putting them onto the Lewis. That's a completely pointless exercise. You want people to say, this is more attractive to me than using my car.
Exactly, and that's the key. And you said it earlier about emissions. We've 8.5 years to reduce our emissions in transport by 51%. The EPA today have already said that we're likely to miss our targets based upon our current plans. So we need to start to think big and imaginative, and this is one of the solutions, okay. I think.
What would you do then, Brian, with all of the parking spaces that would be available and vacant in Dublin if this were all to happen?
There's a huge amount of huge amount of space given up to parking in the city centre. I would suggest, you know, you start to talk to architects and other engineers about what we could do with that space, be it, you know, residential, recreational. There's lots of different uses that we could do for it. I think I worked it out that there would be about 1,090 square metre apartments if the parking, the private car parks were transferred over to other uses.
Okay, and just to explain, where exactly would this congestion charge? Are you talking about inside the M50, or you mentioned the canals there? Explain to us where it would apply.
It would be within the canals, and that would be the most logical place to do it. So we've got a natural coordinate around the city of the canals. We've also got loads of bridges over the canals into the city centre, and that's where I suppose you would place the cameras to capture people coming in and out of the city.
Okay, Conor, how does that suit you on the canals?
Well, no, it sounds horrific, I have to say. And again, it's a remedy worse than the disease because, I mean, even in London, you had 87% of people using public transport before the congestion charge was introduced. And it was perfectly reasonable to regard residual car use as a taxable self-indulgence. But that's just not the situation in Dublin City. And again, clearly, I no longer speak for the AA, but the points that have been made over the years by motorists remain entirely valid. People are crying out for some sort of alternative. Now, the biggest problem Lewis had pre-pandemic was that it was packed. You know, you'd be more logic applying a congestion charge on the Lewis than on the roads. So the capacity just simply isn't there. Dublin needs to build metro. Dublin has needed to build metro for at least 30 years. The best time to start doing it was probably in the 60s. Second best time is now. We need to build metro. And if we don't, talk about a system like Bus Connects, for me, that just frustrates me. It's too small. It lacks vision. Dublin City's been here for 1,000 years. It's going to be here for another 1,000. It's going to need metro. And if you provide serious mass transit in that form, then if you have residual car use, you can look at it as a taxable self-indulgence. But between now and then, it is a fantasy to pretend that our congestion problems, let alone our emissions problems, are caused by motorists who won't do the right thing. It's a fundamentally flawed diagnosis. And okay. I think, you know, busier city than that with other people involved, it's just too simplistic and unlikely to work, I believe.
Conor Faulkner, transport commentator and former director of the AA, disagreeing with the view of Professor Brian Caulfield from the School of Engineering at Trinity College Dublin that we need a congestion charge in Dublin City on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Today is day two of Amazon Prime Day, where the online retail giant supposedly gives big discounts on its product. But a lot of Irish shoppers found that they weren't getting discounts and in many cases were actually being charged more for their purchases. Irish Times consumer champion Conor Pope joined Catherine Thomas on this afternoon's Ray Darcy show to explain what the heck is going on, starting with what Amazon Prime is in the first place.
Amazon Prime is basically like a kind of club that people who use Amazon a lot can join, and it gives them advantages when it comes to shopping online. They get expedited delivery, they get free delivery, and also they can get access to Amazon Prime, the streaming television service. Mm. So, and this Amazon Prime discount day or two is open only to Amazon Prime customers, and the idea is that it happens on Amazon sites all over the world, and they are promising massive discounts across millions of different lines of products that they sell on their site, because as you know, it is the biggest retailer in the world. It's just enormous,
and they were doing huge advertising across Ireland.
Huge advertising, and they were doing online advertising, radio and television advertising. It was a big deal for them, and it quickly emerged for a lot of the Irish customers who were shopping on the Amazon.co.uk website, which is where Irish people can join Prime. They can't join Prime on any of the other Amazon sites across the world. And they were actually, a lot of them were being double charged tax. So they were being charged the VAT that the English government imposes, plus they were being charged the VAT that the Irish government imposes. Now, the way it's supposed to work is that if you're paying tax in Ireland, you don't pay the tax that would be due in the UK. Mm. or if you're paying the tax that was due in the UK, you wouldn't pay the tax that was due in Ireland. And the reason why this has become a problem is largely because of Brexit. Mm. Because in the past, people could shop on Amazon.co.uk, and because the UK was part of the European Union, there was no real tax implications. But now that the UK is outside of the European Union, it's what's known as a third country. So shopping on Amazon.co.uk is the equivalent of shopping on an American-based website or a Chinese-based website or an Australian-based website. Website and all of the taxes and charges that are due. And people have seen that a lot over the last 6 or 7 months when they've been shopping on Amazon. But it became apparent that the discounts that were being applied on the site weren't being applied to Irish customers. So Amazon have recognised that this is a problem. They've said that they're working hard to address it, and they've promised that anybody who paid above the odds for the products that they bought on the first day of the sale will get refunds within 10 days. So I suppose it's good that they've acknowledged that there's an issue. It's bad that it has had to happen for Irish consumers, because apart from the people who bought products and paid too much for them, there will also be people who might have bought products but then have decided at the end going, do you know what, I'm not going to buy that because it's suddenly jumped in price and it's too expensive for me.
And so what would happen if you were in buying whatever, like a tablet or whatever you were buying, you'd see the initial discount, but then when you came to the checkout, the price increased?
Yeah, well, I mean, readers of the Irish Times contacted me, a lot of them contacted me. So one shopper in the Republic tried to buy a pair of Samsung headphones,
right,
and they were listed as £89.
Okay.
And Amazon said that was a discount of 44%. However, at checkout, he was asked to pay €117. And then another customer wanted to buy a Fire Stick, and that allows people to stream content onto their televisions. And the advertised price on the site was £39.99, which again was a discount. And the price that he was charged when he went to pay was €57. And then a third customer, they wanted to buy these earphones, these Echo Bud earphones, which had a list price of £49.99. But again, when they went to actually check out and pay, the price had jumped to £72.99. So suddenly you can see why people would balk at paying the price if it's gone up by 30 or 40%. Because they were the level of discounts that Amazon was saying were attached to the product. But suddenly, because of this glitch in the system, it meant, and some customers were actually ending up paying more than they would have if they'd bought it outside of the so-called Prime Day sale period.
Okay. All right. But it sounds, when you make contact with them, they're rectifying this, they're looking into it, people will be refunded. By what you're saying.
They did apologise. I mean, there was a problem with the system. They've apologised and they've promised they'll do whatever they can to rectify it.
Okay, well, that's all you can ask for. Were any other countries affected like us, Conor?
No, you see, Ireland is quite unique in that we have that very close relationship between Ireland and the UK. So Amazon doesn't have a presence in Ireland, but it does allow Irish people to kind of piggyback on its presence in the UK.
Mm.
So Irish people can't join Prime in Germany, or they can't join Prime in Amazon in Spain, but they are allowed to join it in the UK, on the UK version. But that's why the Irish people were uniquely affected by this problem.
Conor Pope explaining the Armageddon that befell bargain hunters during this year's Amazon Prime Day sale type thingy on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. On the Late Late Show last month, Ryan Tuberty spoke to Katie Healy-Nolan, whose daughter Penelope has special needs. This morning on The Wireless, Ryan caught up with Katie again, and he began by reminding people of Penelope's rare condition.
She has this, just to again put people in the picture who may have missed previous conversations, Katie, a rare genetic disease.
She does, yeah. She's got a disease called PCH syndrome. It kind of affects her cerebellum, which is kind of like the main area of the brain that kind of your balance, things like that. So Penelope kind of effectively always feels like she's at sea, she's rocking a lot, things like that.
And she's four?
She's four and a half, yeah.
And I have a list here. I'm going to read, I hope you don't mind, but just she nonverbal, cannot sit unaided or crawl or weight bear or use her hands or eat and drink unassisted, has visual impairments, digestive issues, and relies heavily on medication.
Yeah.
What does that do in terms of how intense it is to be? Because I know you have boys as well, Rupert and Teddy as well. But for you as a couple and as a family, that's a lot of extra for somebody you absolutely adore.
Yeah, and like that's true. Everything that we do, boils down to Penelope and her needs. Will we be able to go for a drive at a specific time? Does she need fed? Does she need her medications? Will we be home on time? Being a carer to, I'm a mother first, but I'm Penelope's predominant carer. We have to have her routine 100%. There's no deterring from it. We have to do these things for Penelope, and everything boils down to Penelope's needs and trying to accommodate the boys around that so that it's not obvious that we're doing everything for Penelope.
Yes.
But even just at the moment, we're trying to buy a house, and it is 100% based on Penelope's needs. Will this house suit Penelope? You know, it's very intense.
Yeah,
it's
it is.
24/7.
Of course. And even the medication, it is military operation by all accounts.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you cannot, you need to give it at the time that it's required and exact doses. There's no room for error. And that's the thing, when you are a carer, more times than not, you're exhausted and you're drawing up medications late at night or early in the morning. There's just no room for error. You have to be on the ball all the time. Penelope, it would be, to describe Penelope, it's like having a newborn who is the size and weight of your average 4.5-year-old. When I have to lift Penelope into the car and set her into her car seat, she can't put her arms around me to kind of help weight bear. So I'm carrying her. It's a dead weight.
Mm.
So it's just physically exhausting, as well as at times mentally, when you're getting bad news quite a lot of the times, or people speak to you and almost sympathise when they hear that you have a child with special needs. It can be very, very draining. But the physical side is something that kind of, it doesn't get thought about a lot. It's very physically draining on myself and my husband, who himself has you know, an issue with his mobility. So it's tough going.
When people, do you get the head tilt? When,
yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. You know, kind of go, oh, you know, sorry.
It's then. Like, it's generally, it would be how I tell people is, sometimes when I'm in the hairdressers and they ask you, oh, have you any kids? And they say, oh yeah, a little girl and two boys. And they start to ask about Penelope. For a long time, I would just not really get into it, because you don't want to bring the conversation down, because it always does come into, oh God, that must be so hard to have your hopes and dreams dashed, things like that. So to kind of save myself from those conversations when I'm trying to have a break, sometimes I just wouldn't bring it up.
Yeah.
You know, and then I feel like I'm almost hiding Penelope, which is something I certainly am not doing. So now I talk loud and proud about Penelope, because we're very proud of her.
Can I ask you about the chair? Because this chair is critical to Penelope's well-being.
Yes.
What chair are we talking about?
It would be an activity seat for Penelope, something that will hold her posturally very upright and straight. There'll be harnesses on it. It'll be tilted to her, as I was explaining there about her cerebellum.
Yeah.
Penelope's always kind of shaking a bit. It would just help her feel more safe and secure.
Okay.
And also stop the risk of Penelope falling or having an accident, because she'd be properly harnessed in.
And do you have this chair?
No.
No. And do you need this chair?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much does this, the vulgar question, how much would a chair cost you if you were to buy it tomorrow? If you won the lotto, how much would the chair cost?
About 4,000 or 5,000 euro, depending on need, like specific things, requirements.
And what would this chair do to Penelope's quality of your life, and indeed yours as a family?
It would improve her quality of life untold amounts. Penelope would be able to interact with her brothers a little better. We could lower her down to their level so that they could play with her at her little table in front of the chair, that she would be safe, that she would have the independence when she's feeding, not to be sitting on our knee for an hour and a half, 2 hours. Penelope's peg fed, so it all goes through a pump.
How long have you been waiting for this chair?
Penelope outgrew her own chair in November last year.
Mm-hmm.
And she has been without it since November.
And are you in a queue for the chair? Is there a system? Is there some class of, you know, take a ticket, wait your turn?
Yes, that's effectively it. We flagged up the issue, obviously, last November, that Penelope had outgrown her own chair, and that was just kind of taking up space in our house. They're a large piece of equipment and she needed to be put on the list for the next size up effectively. So we've been waiting since November, trying to put pressure on services with the progression of disability. There was a handover of service. You kind of wanted to get things sorted before all that came into effect, but unfortunately it didn't. So yeah, we're just in a long queue waiting for Penelope to get sorted.
And who do you call? I mean, I'm just trying to figure, I'm trying to put my walk a mile in your shoes, as it were, and find out who would, I'd be very frustrated. I'd be probably a little bit angry, which would be a waste of emotion, but I probably would be anyway, because I'd be so furious because how protective we are of our own children, obviously. And I'd want to start making noise, as you feel rightly the need to do. So who do you call, or you know, and do you get through to humans, or are you constantly on to, you know, automated services, or how does that work?
Well, the route I like to go through is through the service provider that we're with. I get on to Penelope's occupational therapist and people like that, OTs, and try and get answers, try to put a little bit of pressure on. But there's only so much that they can do for these children. They're in the same system that we're in. They're doing the absolute utmost for their clients. But unfortunately, it's systematic failings that have us in the position that we're in.
Okay. When you came on the Late Late Show in May, the night before you appeared on with us, you got a phone call from the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin.
Yes.
And was there anything specific he was able to promise you, or was it just a broad supportive noises being made or sounds being made?
He was offering his support and telling me that, you know, he was himself slightly confused as to why we had such a long wait for certain things. He said that there is funding there. But whenever I'm talking to people in the services that are working in the service, they're the ones who tell me that it's a funding issue that has us, you know, in the queue that we're in.
Okay.
It was just, he was offering his support. He was being very kind and polite, mm-hmm. but that's all it was. It was just a phone call.
Now, you spent €3,000 on a Peapod?
Yeah.
What's that?
It was close to 3,000. It wasn't exactly three, but it's a large pastoral bean bag for Penelope. It's essentially a big bean bag on wheels that has a supportive foam mould on it. Now, this is supposed to be used as kind of like an end-of-day relaxation chair, or when Penelope's very flat and not terribly active, that we can put her in there and she can be comfortable. But it's certainly by no means a chair that a child who cannot sit is to be put in for the entire day. And that's the current situation that we're in. If Penelope's not in the beanbag, she's sitting on our knees, or we're holding her.
And the week before you came on the Late Show with us, there was a problem with that, or at least there was a freak accident.
Yeah, Penelope has a condition called dystonia. So she tends to thrash a lot, and she has involuntary spasms. And she obviously was thrashing very hard, and she tipped out of the chair, and She really did hurt herself. She did have a slight concussion, and it was the worst thing for us as a family to see, because when we first were being told that Penelope, it was looking like there was something serious for her, we were told things that kind of lessen your life, and being not able to put your hands out when you fall was a huge area. And I remember saying to David, that's never going to happen, because she's never going to fall. And she fell, and it was the worst moment of our lives and the biggest failing as a mother, that happened. Her,
you're harsh on yourself now. I'm going to intervene here and say you're harsh on yourself.
It's very difficult.
I'm only saying it to you because it's not fair that you feel that you failed in that regard, because every day is our micro victories, and you can't let one micro accident make it sound like a failure. And I hope you don't mind me saying that this isn't patronising. It's just, I can hear it in you, and it's not fair. You shouldn't be feeling that way. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's keep going. You happy to keep going?
Yeah. Thank you.
Right,
sorry.
Well,
God.
Don't be sorry. This is what it's all about. Life is not a straight road. So I just wanted to catch up with you about all of this, because it drives me slightly mad that there are parents listening to the programme this morning with children like yours, like Penelope, and they seem to be without a voice. And yeah. they seem to be without hope. And they seem to be without funding. And they seem to be without what I would have thought was a human right, and that is the right to sit in a chair.
That's how I feel about it. And that's why I am using my voice and I'm making a bit of a fuss. And sometimes when you're listening in, people mightn't understand, like, God, it's only a chair. Like, it's not. But it is everything to Penelope. It's something people can't grasp. She cannot sit. If we were to prop her in a chair, she simply would slide and fall. It is just the cruelty of the position that we're in is beyond measure. I've begged for the borrow of a chair whilst we get one ourselves, and it's falling on deaf ears over and over again. We're constantly told we can't be given things because it's a health and safety issue, yet they don't seem to care what's happening at home.
Where did you get your bath seat?
The kindness of a family who saw our struggles on Instagram. They contacted me and offered us a bath seat that belonged to a little girl called Saoirse who passed away, and they wanted to pass on Saoirse's equipment to Penelope so that she could bath in a dignified manner and safely. And it was delivered to our door by Saoirse's mother, and the kindness and consideration that a family who have had their own struggles and massive loss to come to our door and to meet Penelope and to support us in that way, it means more than any speech through the HSE would ever mean. It is just the most beautiful thing. And Penelope, when she first used it, the happiness, and for the first time in over a year and a half, Penelope was able to splash in the bath and feel the warm water around her body and not have myself or David worrying that we're going to drop her. It was just a lifeline handed to us by an incredible family.
Ryan summed up Katie and Penelope's current situation.
You're using a shower seat that was given to you by a family who are bereaved to say, we think you could do with this. You're using a buggy that was given to you on loan from a charity that do the kindest things for families who are in trouble, the Jack and Jill Foundation. And yet no seat.
No.
It's quite disturbing.
It is. And I think sometimes that's the very difficult thing about this situation is I genuinely hold very strong beliefs that the HSE have known that people help people in their areas of need when they don't step in. And I think it is an absolute disgrace that in Ireland in 2021 there is a child, and I'm a mother who's using my voice. I've been on the Late Late show. Everyone has heard our story, yet Penelope is still without. So my question is, what about the families who do not speak out because they're worried about losing services? What's happening to these children? We're not hearing their stories. And I want to use my voice as much for Penelope, but for other families. And when the day comes where Penelope's not with me, I hope that I'll have the strength to rally round and use my voice for these families, because their story is not being heard. There's hundreds of families whose story is not being heard. And even when your story is heard, it falls on deaf ears. That has to change, and I'm going to try my best to work to change it.
That's Katie Healy-Nolan talking to Ryan Tuberty about her daughter Penelope's struggles to get a chair suitable to her special needs. You can donate to Penelope's GoFundMe page by going to GoFundMe.com and searching for Penelope. Recent figures published by the National Treatment Purchase Fund show that there are around 90,000 children on public waiting lists for treatment in Irish hospitals. Today with Clare Byrne reporter Evelyn O'Rourke met some of the families and their doctors, starting with Dr. Erwin Gill, paediatrician at Temple Street Children's Hospital.
What I see in my clinic on a weekly basis, we meet families who tell us that when they've gotten through the assessment process, which can often take an extremely long time, what they're told is that in terms of the waiting time to actually get help, therapy for their children, in North Dublin, I've had children in my clinic the last few weeks who've been told they must wait over 3 years for that kind of intervention. So to put that in context, that means that a child who is referred at the age of two won't get any help whatsoever from disability services until they're in school, which is essentially as good as no service at all. And to put this in context, in other countries in which I've worked, in the UK and in Australia, it wouldn't be unusual to expect a child to be enrolled in early intervention perhaps within 3 or 4 months of having been referred, whereas here it's 3 or 4 years. So I think a lot of this has become very normalised. We've gotten very used to children with disabilities having to wait for everything, and I think people have lost sight of the fact that this is not the way that most countries do it. It's not normal at all, nor is it acceptable, and I think it reflects a level of comfort with it that we shouldn't have. We've gotten very, very focused in this country on the headline issue of assessment times being the thing that's the most important, and we've lost track of the fact that the intervention with therapy teams is what actually makes a meaningful difference. And the families who I see here in clinics who are waiting for years with no help whatsoever are often distraught. I can see that children don't get those early years back. We have a meaningful window in the early years with children to intervene and to get them in with expert therapy. Criticisms of waiting times, from my perspective, is not criticisms of the people who are actually providing the therapy, it's criticism of the system.
In terms of you working with your colleagues, it must be deeply frustrating then.
We do what we can. Part of the work obviously is advocating, so we will write our letters to say this patient has been, you know, they're back to see me again for the second time in 6 months or 9 months or a year or however long it's been. Ultimately, there's only so much therapy time or so much intervention time to go around, and you know, we write these letters because we feel we have to do something. But ultimately speaking, if the system isn't resourced to provide timely intervention, it doesn't matter what letters we write, is the truth of it, that the system is not set up for success. That can be incredibly frustrating. It certainly can, yeah.
Dr. Erwin Gill from Temple Street Children's Hospital. Evelyn also spoke to the marvellously named Deep End group of GPs who are working in some of the most disadvantaged areas of the country. Professor Susan Smith is a GP in Inchicore, Dublin 8, and also a professor of general practice in the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. She told Evelyn about Deep End's concerns for vulnerable paediatric patients.
Our main aim is to try and advocate, to try and ensure that services are based on need rather than on your ability to shout loudest or pay.
But at this point then, what are you looking for? Like, what is the clear advocacy line from Deep End in terms of this issue?
So we've been really concerned about waiting lists for services for disability and for mental health for children. And we work as GPs in disadvantaged areas, and it really affects those communities much more. That's for two reasons. Firstly, children are more likely to have needs in those communities. And secondly, there isn't really the escape valve of private services. So, for example, in one of the more affluent community health organisations in Ireland, there's about 370 children on a waiting list for speech and language therapy. And then in the more disadvantaged community health organisation, it's 2,800. So there's an eightfold difference in the number of children waiting. The other thing that's been happening has been a huge focus on assessment, and that's welcome. But the difficulty is that it's all about assessment now. And really, assessment without intervention has very little meaning for a child. And we are really advocating for major reform. There's a new system called Progressing Disabilities, which is seeking to address the challenges around assessment of need and the long waiting times for it. And in doing that, imbalancing the system further towards assessment and away from intervention. From a GP perspective, we feel we should be more involved in planning. Everybody says go to your GP when you've any problem, and yet we're not brought in enough in terms of planning services. And we are the first port of call for many of these families, and we know it's happening, so we should plan to do something about it.
Professor Susan Smith, GP and Deep End Ireland member. Finally, Evelyn spoke to a family at the mercy of the waiting lists that prevail in Ireland. Danielle Fogarty is mother to 6-year-old Cree, who's been given an assessment of likely autism, which Danielle finds confusing. She's been told that he needs a range of supports, but that the waiting list is up to 30 months.
Cree went down on these waiting lists back in 2019 when I first started all this. Now it says that there's a 30-month waiting list since June of 2020. So I reckon another 2 years before the school age team can give Cree any type of help. He needs psychology, he needs speech and language therapy, and he needs occupational therapist. This is what the recommendations on the report have. He won't walk really anywhere. Like, I still have a buggy for him.
But all of those involve a waiting list.
yeah, we're just at a standstill now and I just have to wait. He struggles, repetitive movements, mimicking, attention span, not being able to sit on the seat for long. Cree has a blocked bowel and they say it's linked in with the autism. So he's on Movicol every day for that.
How do you feel about the waiting list situation?
Oh, it's absolutely shocking. Like they said it was 30 months last year. It's probably gotten longer now with COVID. He can be very aggressive. He doesn't mean it. It's just he struggles really with his emotions and stuff. Like he's not a great eater. So I feel like I have to argue with him or fight with him to eat. He sleeps, but he rocks during the night.
Do you believe that if he got supports and services, that it would help him?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, COVID didn't help either, but I've seen big, big changes in him. Even down to trying to get him out to school in the morning can be very difficult. And if he had some help and support that we could even incorporate it at home, it would be really good. But I just feel like I'm now at a standstill unless I pay for it myself. And don't get me wrong, he's the best little boy, but it's big money and he needs psychology, he needs speech and language, and he needs occupational therapy. Which one do you choose that you think he needs most?
Danielle Fogarty, whose son Cree has to wait up to 30 months to access vital support services. Danielle was talking to Today with Claire Byrne reporter Evelyn O'Rourke. Frances spoke to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Liveline about her daughter's graduation from primary school.
Basically, I suppose I'm speaking, thanks a million for the opportunity to speak for all parents of sixth class students leaving primary school, and because we've explored all the avenues at this stage between ministers and email addresses to the government, and you're the only outlet we've received at this stage. But yeah, I'm speaking for all the parents because I suppose since the 7th of June, we're supposed to be allowed to have organised outdoor events, and there's supposed to be allowed a maximum of 100 people allowed. But graduations have all been reverted to Zoom calls or Zoom videos at this stage, and we're just looking for, we think that at this stage that the government should consider that after the 15 months that the kids have had in sixth class, that they really should earn their rite of passage. You know, they've missed an awful lot already in sixth class, all their rites of passage, you know, school trips and GAA sports, is playing in Croke Park in our school, and in particular, that's a big event. So, and they become entrepreneurs and they, you know, create money and events that get them, our school in particular, go to Delphi for 2 days. And all these events have been kind of, you know, denied by the kids. And they were, my daughter in particular came home crying the other day when she found out that it was going to be a recorded video and that the parents weren't allowed to attend.
Really? Was she that engaged or invested in this idea of having parents attending the graduation?
Was my daughter?
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, they wait for sixth class. They wait for this final event. I mean, I personally, I have three children and this is my last one in that school. And it's a big deal for her to sit beside. I mean, my son graduated last year and it was in the middle of the pandemic and it was a lot. We were at a different stage and basically we were allowed to sit beside him. And it is important. And for me as well, at a personal level, I'm saying goodbye to the school. And for every parent that's there, whether it's your first, last or middle child, you like to be there. I mean, I have been going to that school. It's a Gaelic school and I opted to send them to that. It's been a tough 13 years getting kids down to a Gaelic school because it's not in my village. And, you know, I haven't been able to go into the school for the last year and a half. And, you know, I can't walk back into that school again. And I'd like to see my daughter graduate as I did with my other two children. And I think it's really important. And yeah, I mean, she wants me there. Yeah.
And yeah. Have you spoken to the school about it? Like, why are they taking the route?
The school have been amazing. The school have been amazing. They've tried their best to make everything as you know, as enjoyable as possible. They've organised one outdoor event, they've organised events and stuff, but they are governed by the education guidelines. So they've basically, we all emailed them and there's nothing they can do. Their hands are tied. They've sent us the email they got from the department and there's nothing they can do about it.
A long statement from the Department of Education as well, but basically saying, as I'm sure the email you saw said, Frances, schools will not be in a position to facilitate the attendance of parents or other family members at graduation ceremonies.
Yeah. As you said, it's an outdoor event. The guidelines are that 100 people are allowed to attend organised outdoor events. So that's why we kind of all as parents assumed we were going to be going to it. And I mean, their confirmation is going ahead. That's an indoor event. They're allowed to have two persons sitting in the church indoors at a confirmation, you know, and that's not
when will that
the same
be,
issue.
Francis?
That's the 6th of July, yes. Things could change, but that's the 6th of July.
And the graduation is what date is that happening?
Next Friday. Now, the school have been amazing. They've recorded a video last Friday. That was their graduation ceremony. And they said they are available for Plan B if guidelines were lifted. So I just think it's up to the government at this stage that they do. They should consider that after the 15 months the children have had, that they do earn the rite of passage to have their parents present at the graduation ceremony.
Could it be, though, Frances, that many parents, given, you know, the circumstances, given what we heard, I think if anyone heard the news this morning about the Delta variant, that many parents would be not very comfortable about being in any sort of a gathering, and that when you might have that scenario, it would be better to have no parents there rather than just the parents who are comfortable with being there, it's such a big moment in all those children's lives.
With a child in sixth class, a lot of us are vaccinated. My husband personally is doubly vaccinated because he works for the HSE. But a lot of parents would be vaccinated. We attended the ceremony last year. There was no outbreak after it. The school has been COVID-free, from my knowledge, since they returned to school at this stage. So, I mean, all the guidelines you're listening to is that the schools are not causing any of the outbreaks and stuff like that. So, it has the capacity to host 100 people if they wanted. But with the confirmations, they're separating them into, you know, even if you did one class, because Grail schools only have, in my personal situation, there's only two classes. So you could separate them into twos if you wanted, 13 per class, because there's, you know, 13, and then two parents attend or whatever. Even one parent, it's just the kids. Look, the parents do want to be there. I know you're saying maybe they don't. We have a group. Every parent wants to be there in the group. I haven't had one
Is that
negative
group of
feedback.
All the parents from that sixth class?
From that sixth class, yeah. You know the way you set up your own personal WhatsApp groups for the parents and stuff like that.
I do. The bane of many parents' lives.
Yeah,
Francis.
I know. Yeah, turn off your notifications. But no, personally, look, there's not one of them. Everyone, I've told them I'm going on. They want me to represent them. You know, they want to be heard. They've emailed, you know, they've emailed local TDs, they've emailed the school. So everybody does want to be involved. I mean, they're standing outside the railings with the hope that they might see him walking out at the end of the graduation. They definitely do want to be there.
That's Frances telling Katie Hannan how disappointed she is that her daughter's school can't have an in-person graduation ceremony for sixth class. There wasn't much sympathy for her plight from callers, I'm afraid, but you'll have to listen back on the RTE radio player if you want to hear how mean they were to poor Frances. Finally, on Playback Daily, fencing, climbing, skateboarding. Which of these activities is an Olympic sport? The answer? All of them. Claire Byrne spoke to fencer Hannah Lowry O'Reilly, high-altitude climber Pat Falvey, and skateboarder Dion McGarrity about the forthcoming Olympics and the minority sports that a lot of people might not realise are part of the biggest sporting event of them all.
It's so athletic that people don't really understand how the amount of fitness and training that goes into it. You have to have such leg strength, and then that's all aside from the skills that you need for your arms and your eye coordination, your eye-hand coordination, and the sword skills. So it really is, it's a tough game, but it's very rewarding.
So talk us through the basics then of the aim of the game.
Well, the aim of the game is to get to 15. So a match goes to 15. And in, let's say, take for example my weapon, which is épée, you get a point when you hit your opponent, and you can hit them anywhere on the body, and a light goes off. You're hooked up to an electric spool, so a light goes off, and if you see the light go off, then you've got the point. But if two lights go off, then both players get a point.
Okay, and then of course on your side, defensively, you're acting all the time to avoid that happening to you.
That's it. So you kind of run up and down the piste so that you run away from your opponent and attack, so you're moving up the piste.
Your experience then when you went to the Polish training camp?
Talk to us about that. That was tough. God, we got up at 6 a.m. every morning for a run, and then that was followed by a 3-hour training session, then lunch, and then another 3-hour training session, and then another 3-hour training session. I think every night I got into bed, my body was spasming uncontrollably every night. It was so tough, but it was worthwhile. It was great. But I think my friend and I, at the end of it, we slept for a week when we got home. It was
so they take it very seriously.
Very seriously. And we saw the Hungarian fencing team training when we were over there, and they take it. Oh, it's amazing to watch them. They're like ballerinas or I don't know, gymnasts. They're so incredible. And the weight training that they were doing, the leg training. Oh, it was just amazing. The point training, it's all about repetition. So you just have to keep practicing, hitting the target. It's amazing to watch it at that level.
Now, Ireland doesn't send a fencing team, do we, to
no,
the Olympics?
No, we're not the strongest fencing nation. We have sent 17 fencers over the years since 1948. I think the last was Siobhan Byrne in 2008 in the Beijing Olympics. But I think there's a lot of upcoming fencers, so hopefully in the future we will see more Irish fencers competing, because it's really a fantastic sport.
However, all is not lost, because there will be one Irish athlete who will be wielding a sword.
That's it, Natalia Coyle. She is a modern pentathlete, and she's heading over, and she went to London and also to Rio. She's an amazing, amazing athlete, and so fencing is part of modern pentathlon. Mm. It's running, shooting, swimming and horse riding as well. So she's
and you trained
incredible.
With her.
I trained with her in Trinity. Yeah. We had some great bouts. So Tal's a fantastic girl. So wishing her all the best over there. And, you know, hopefully she'll really just kick ass and hopefully medal.
It's extraordinary when you think about what she's going to do. You've explained the athleticism around one discipline.
That's it. But I mean, to go off and train for five different sports, it's unbelievable. It's incredible, the amount of hard work and dedication, but it's fantastic. And she's such a strong fencer as well. You know, she could almost go off and fence for Ireland at the Olympics, and as well as run for Ireland or swim for Ireland. I mean, she's incredible. She really is. So hopefully she'll do really well over there.
Well, Pat Falvey, as I said, is with us too. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Claire. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. For the first time, your own sport will be represented at the Olympics.
Yeah, and it's great. And I think all the fraternity, all the people that are involved, both in the climbing side of it, in the sport climbing side, and the bouldering side, we're all very excited, because it's bringing a whole new impetus into our own sport, which is that of climbing. And we have lots and lots of people taking it up, as you can see, climbing walls shooting up all around the place, young people getting involved. And to have the sport, you know, represented in the Olympics will just add to this and add the enthusiasm of the people that's getting involved. And I think that's very, very important. And it's the same there, as Hannah has said, like, you know, it just instills great enthusiasm for other people that are in the sport to actually become better at it.
Okay, so in the Olympics, we'll have lead climbing, speed climbing and bouldering. Will you take us through those three?
Yeah, well, lead climbing would be where that, in other words, you have to put in the protection, and basically they'll keep moving the handholds, and they'll be making more difficult. And it is the person that would probably get to the best score in relation to getting up a climb will become the winners. And being honest, you know, nowadays it's just gone to the fact that climbing isn't even like climbing anymore. Like, you nearly at that level, you're nearly a gymnast. Mm-hmm. And as Hannah has said, the time they'd be putting in, like, you know, from weightlifting to, you know, training to being out on the crag, you know, is just phenomenal. The time that these people put in to their passion is amazing. And it's the same with speed climbing. What they'll be doing is they'll be testing probably the same, you know, holes and things like that, but it's the speed at which they can get to the top. Like, if you ever like watch some of the pictures there of free solos or anything like that, it's people lunging from place to place. It's just their ability, the magic of it, the beauty of it, actually seeing them move is incredible. And it'll bring a whole new, you know, interest to the sport, because there is thousands and thousands at the moment in Ireland, like, getting involved in all of those, and from all ages, like from 6 years of age, like some people there have kids, they bring them to the climbing wall. And it's amazing the talent that they have, but to have a sport like this now, it will increase that interest, that they have somewhere that they can take their Everest to if they're in that athletic type of a sport.
And what's bouldering then?
Bouldering is where that there's a boulder, and that, you know, like if you look at it even around anywhere that you go, like, you could see boulders, and what they do is that they go out and they try to make all the hard moves to get up on top of it. I'm not too sure at this stage in the Olympics, like what they're considering as bouldering, whether they have boulder fields or like that they have in France and things like that. But it is, again, like about testing your ability, your agility, your speed, your flexibility, you know, to be in all type of contorted situations and to get up and over these things safely.
Dion, as I said, McGarrity is with us as well. Killing time skateboards. I was watching some of your videos on YouTube this morning, and to me it appeared as though someone had glued the skateboard to your feet. I know that that's not what happens, but tell us first of all how you got involved in the sport.
I got involved back when I was, say, 9 or 10. It would have been about 2000. From me to playing the Tony Hawk's games, or I had like friends and family that were kind of interested in skateboarding, so I got into it then. And then I went on a holiday over to Australia, and I seen some of the skate parks that were over there. And the scene, obviously, back then was very small here compared to over there. So when I came back, that kind of triggered it a bit more for me. And ever since then, I just kept it up.
And how do you feel about skateboarding then being an Olympic sport? Like, it's a very free-flowing thing to do, isn't it, when you're out in the park or the skate park or wherever. Should it be, does it feel wrong to have it as a structured sport in the Olympics?
In a way, it's kind of mixed opinion about it, I guess. Depends what kind of skateboarders you'd be talking to. But it's great exposure for it, especially for the facilities around the world when the skate parks are building. It's just good for the skateboarders to be in it.
And how do you think it'll work from a marking system point of view? Do you know at this stage?
Each skater will have three runs that are 1 minute long. And then I think if it's to go by, there's another competition in America called Street League, which has been kind of nearly like the run-up competitions to the Olympics. So they've been doing that a few years. So we've known for about 3-4 years that skateboarding is actually going to be in the Olympics. And then at the end, they have a 5 best trick. So you can add up your points through that.
And what is the nation? You mentioned America there in the Street League. Is America the nation to watch out for, do you think, when it comes to the Olympics?
Yeah, they will definitely be the best. They have some of the best skateboarders in the world there. And that, as I said, the Street League has been a platform used because it's on every year a few times. So you win trophies through that.
The best of the best will be going through that one.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how it's been done. But there's other great skateboarders as well from Brazil. And there's also an amazing one that skates in the Street League from Japan. But he'll be representing Japan over there.
What about Sky Brown? Tell us about this 12-year-old. She's in line to be selected for the Great Britain Olympic team, isn't she?
Yeah, she's fairly amazing. There's a lot of great female young skateboarders that are coming up. I think she might live in America at the moment, but she'll be representing over there. She injured herself last year in the shoulder. But she, for her that young, representing is pretty amazing to do.
Mm-hmm. Is it dangerous?
Yeah, definitely. I've hurt myself a lot, but it's just part of it. We're kind of rewarding, I guess, when you land tricks, especially with street skateboarding, which is much preferred over here.
Skateboarder Dion McGarrity, who along with fencer Hannah Lowry O'Reilly and high altitude climber Pat Falvey, was talking to Claire Byrne about minority sports at the Olympics. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio Player. And there'll be another edition of Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. But for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.